This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us for the Ed Johnson Conversations, Part 3. In 1906, Ed Johnson, a young black man, was falsely accused and wrongfully convicted of a crime he did not commit here in Chattanooga, the assault and rape of Nevada Taylor, a young white woman. Johnson's case reached the United States Supreme Court, which issued a stay of execution, but a violent mob took the law into its own hands and lynched him on the Walnut Street Bridge. From his arrest, through his trial, to the final moments of his life, Ed Johnson said again and again, "I am an innocent man." We are bringing you a series of conversations with members of the Ed Johnson Project about his story from more than a century ago and the memorial in this century at the south end of the bridge where his life ended. This hour, we hear from the Reverend Paul A. McDaniel. Now retired, he served as pastor of Second Missionary Baptist Church in Chattanooga for nearly 5 decades and is a former Hamilton County Commissioner. Eleanor McCauley Cooper is a Chattanooga native, author, and community activist. Donovan Brown is the director of the Horton Keller Center for Traumatic Healing in East Chattanooga and the current chair of the Ed Johnson Project Committee. We begin at the Hamilton County Jail in 1906. Reverend McDaniel, Eleanor, Donovan, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ray.
Yes, it's a pleasure to be with you.
March 18th. 1906, a Sunday. Ed Johnson at the county jail, he receives visitors.
Well, the jail gives the inmate an opportunity to make a request. In some cases, those who've been convicted of crimes have the opportunity to get outside of the jail and perhaps see a site which is remarkable and important to them. In this case, Ed Johnson made what they deemed to be an unusual request, and that was to go to church. Now, at the time, Sheriff Shipp did not want that to unfold, want that to happen.
Joseph F. Shipp, the Hamilton County Sheriff in 1906.
But there was an invitation extended to a local pastor in a local church. So instead of Ed Johnson being able to go to church, the church came to Ed Johnson. Now, the jail didn't anticipate that many folks would show up, but over 300 people came to the jail that day. In the midst of the service, Ed Johnson indicated that he himself, back in Knox County, had come to gain faith in Christ. And it was a remarkable day of celebration and preaching. And Ed Johnson was reported as being one of expressing both jubilance and relief. He seemed to be a man who knew his fate. Whether or not he was going to be lynched, he knew that his eternal fate was secure. Also on that day, someone from the church said, you know, we want to invite Ed Johnson to become a member of the church. And there were no folks in the church that voted no. Everybody voted yes. But the only way that Ed Johnson could be invited in as a member is that he had to be baptized. So on this very afternoon, with 300 folks around inside the jail, they found an old tub and filled it full of water. And Ed Johnson was baptized on that day. So that's the context leading up to the tragedies that unfollowed. But we know that from Ed Johnson's story that it was back in Knox County when he was in jail where he came to know Christ. He had his own conversion experience, even though details of that are unknown to the general public. But on that day, it was a church came to him. They worshiped together. He was baptized and invited in as a member of the church.
The details of that conversion may be unclear, but one thing that is clear is what he was quoted as saying in the Chattanooga Times Daily Press, as it was called. And I'm just going to read that quotation. "I have had a change of heart, and I am ready to die. The change came over me all at once, and I can't tell how it was. Before the change, I hated the people that were against me. I couldn't eat and could only think of the arrest and the trouble I was in. I didn't want to talk or eat and didn't want to see anyone. All at once, I said that I was willing to give up my friends and folks and life itself if I had to. And then I felt different. I didn't hate the white people anymore. My appetite returned, and I am proud now to have anybody come to see me. Someone asked me that day what made me eat, and I said that I felt different and was ready to face anybody. This change of feeling has stayed with me, and I feel that way yet." Reverend McDaniel, when we talk about somebody professing their faith, somebody giving their testimony, that is as clear and as powerful as that can possibly be.
Yes, I think that testimony is very powerful. I could just imagine his countenance when he gave the statement of his belief, not only in Christ, but his change of his attitude toward others, and that it must have touched, it did touch those who were there. If I recall, that there was a very emotional reaction to his statement, praising God and moving away from the idea of the tragedy that would happen soon, but rejoicing in the fact that here was one who felt free, free from any harm that any person could do, that he was, as our brother has said, secure, secure in his term salvation, that reflected in his present situation. He became no more one who held the great sense of sorrow, even for his situation, but that he almost looked upon those who came to kill him as people who were troubled and needed what he had, and that was peace. I think that in the book Contempt of Court, that it was stated that his presence, his countenance was a such that shocked the people, that made them actually more angry, because he was not hollering, you know, for his life, but had accepted his fate. It, to me, when I read that, it just tells you what can happen, that God can do to a person, even in the midst of death, that he can witness in. And he cried out, and his theme is, I am an innocent man. They sought to twist him and make him confess even at the end, but he did not. He held to his fact that he was innocent, but he felt no more grudges against those who sought to kill him, and said his farewell, and even said, we'll meet again in the sweet by and by.
Ray, might be noted that the sheriff actually expected something quite different from this. He knew from Ed Johnson that he wanted to say something to the congregation, but the sheriff was hoping it was a confession, because confession would lead to forgiveness. But instead of a confession, he said that statement that you read. And so I think the sheriff was a little taken aback, because if he had confessed, it would be a lot easier for the sheriff to proceed.
The sheriff imagined that it would be confession of guilt. But in essence, what Ed Johnson did is he confessed to a deliverance. One can say that he had been in the midst of the valley of the shadow of death, or one could say that he himself was a victim of PTSD. He was deeply depressed about the tragedy which had befallen him. But what he described is remarkable. I think that a therapist or a mental health clinician might describe that as being some kind of delusion or some kind of miracle, that in the midst of the great weight that he felt emotionally, psychologically, he felt that weight no longer, and that he was able to display a sense of grace and forgiveness. And even though I know the story, as I sit here listening to us talking, I'm feeling this sense of, muted optimism and warmth, just understanding the steadfastness of his person. So the sheriff and the jailers expected a confession of guilt, but he confessed to being delivered of a wearied state.
In reading those words to myself before we started this conversation, and then just now during this conversation a few moments ago, I was struck both times by the simplicity, the serenity, the sincerity of what he said and how he said it.
Yes, I agree with that. And I was impressed by the fact that his adversaries were shaken by that peace, that status that he had now, facing an angry mob, that he was at peace with himself and with them. Maybe that's what we need today. That's the lesson we could get maybe from this story, that if we are all in the midst of various tragic events, if we can move from hatred to that of concern for our brothers in love, yes, maybe that's the story we could even talk about now, as he speaks, though he has died.
The sheriff really wanted a confession, but I think it was more than a confession. It was also looking for an affirmation, a validation of everything that had been done up to this point to Ed Johnson.
That's right.
I agree.
I think Donovan said it very well a minute ago. He wanted a confession so that he, the sheriff, could feel righteous in following the law. That's the way he saw it. He was fulfilling the law, and a man was guilty, therefore he had to be killed. Again, let's take the scene a little bit later to the bridge, and the men who are about to lynch him ask him again for a confession. And he once again responds in this spirit of love and compassion and says, "God bless you all. I am an innocent man." So that spirit was had to be genuine at that scene to act that way, to say those words.
I also can imagine that Ed Johnson could have been justifiably angry, justifiably disenchanted with the fact that he'd been so failed by the American judicial system. One could argue that the nature of the American apartheid system, as it was at the time living under Jim Crow, was its own kind of fundamental failure and being systemically unjust. So the fact that he displayed that kind of grace in the moment may not mean that that could be the only reasonable response at a time of being a victim of that kind of crime. I think sometimes what's projected upon African Americans, that of course, under all circumstances, we are to express grace and forgiveness. And I'm one who believes in grace and forgiveness. And one can both express grace and forgiveness, but also frustration and anger, not hatred, but frustration and anger about a malformed justice. And I'm also thinking back to the men on the bridge. What they likely wanted to see, they too wanted to be either affirmed that Ed Johnson was guilty and affirmed how they saw justice, or at least absolved in what they sensed might have truly been criminal. Because there may have been more than an element of guilt that they were feeling. It may have been that they were on the verge of feeling the weight of their own crimes. And so when Ed Johnson was in their presence, neither afraid nor expressing guilt, but actually expressing grace, I can understand as to why that could enrage them, because he's not giving them what they want. And that is the sign of a guilty man, the sign of an angry man. Then at that point, all they could do, the only license they had, was their own broken moral compass.
He's not giving them what they want, and what he is giving them, they just can't handle. They won't handle, and they're not having it, and then they proceed to lynch him. There's a lot of symbolism here with the church coming to Ed Johnson on a Sunday of all days. Talk to me more about that.
When I read this, it was interesting because I had also read that when the lawyers sought to solicit funds to help support the appeal, it was very difficult, even in a black community, maybe for two or three reasons. But if the black community felt that the accusation was true, then they were not going to give support to that sort of behavior. And also, there were those who were afraid by it not being true, but yet giving support to a person who was accused, that they may have faced some violence themselves. So I was taken by that point. And then when it turned around, when his request was made, I think that must have been a process that the questions would really been raised. Was he really guilty? And when the request came for the church, for his opportunity to share with the church, that they overwhelmingly showed their concern, as was stated with these 300 folks coming to the jail and sharing in that service. So I was pleased by the show of support he received from his own people. And I think that his testimony so moved them that they were able to secure funds to deal with the expenses later on with the lawyers.
Yeah, I also wonder if many of the African-American residents of Chattanooga saw it as a lost cause, that if a black man, if Negro is accused of that kind of crime in this part of the country or in any part of the country, frankly, that whether guilty or innocent, a jury of folks who are actually not his peers are not going to side if he's innocent with justice. So sometimes they may have deemed it a bad investment. Not that they didn't believe that Ed Johnson was innocent, but it really didn't matter because the nature of the justice system was so profoundly and utterly unjust for African Americans. But the idea of church visiting him, to me, is still such a remarkable sight, I imagine. I know in scripture, as Christ calls the saints to go, and then you see the same thing unfolding after the church is formed when they're seeking to make and convert new saints. But I think the idea of the symbolism, and I think one of the reasons as to why this story of Ed Johnson is so compelling to so many people, it's the nature of the symbols and the intensity of the symbols. He himself being innocent, he himself uttering words akin to the words that Christ uttered. He's standing in front of violent and violent actors being calm and expressing grace. But this image of hundreds of parishioners shifting up their Sunday service patterns, because it's good to be in the house of the Lord. And I can't imagine that too many jails are sparked by the brightness and the warmth of being in a church service, the building itself. And so they entered into the gray, dark, maybe even wet jail cell, filled with folks who indeed some are guilty, but they gather together in the hundreds to worship God in the midst of Ed Johnson, and then also able to receive him as a brother, to see him baptized and also to hear his confession. So I think I'm grateful to hear the way that church mobilized in those moments where they could have, as Eleanor noted, experienced some kind of retaliation, as Pastor also noted, for being there on that Sunday with Ed Johnson.
I've had the experience of taking members of my congregation to a jail on various occasions for a service with the inmates, and I was pleased their response, not condemning those who were there, but yet sharing with them as brothers and sisters. Yes.
I'm also struck by how the people who came to the jail that day, even if they thought that Ed Johnson, his case, was a lost cause by that point, they still felt compelled to come, to welcome him into their arms, even if it were just a matter of hours or days left in his life, accepting his testimony. And by accepting his testimony, expressing their testimony and what all of them together believed at that moment.
I'm sure there were those within that group had also been falsely accused of various activities. Even when I read it, I remember my coming up that I was falsely accused on two occasions, really, because of the identity problem. And I always can still look back on that and identify with those who are falsely accused. And Ed Johnson just was the type of man by character and reputation that didn't fit in the description of the person who so did this act. And I think eventually the Black community was relieved of that and expressed it in their religious experience of testifying and of sharing according to the Black religious tradition. They had church that day.
You know, I was thinking, Pastor, that given the state of their lives in the early part of the 20th century, African Americans had endured over 2.5 centuries of being falsely accused of being subhuman, falsely accused of being cursed, and that Blackness was a sign of God's curse, and that curse was to be subservient, to be enslaved, to be of lowly disposition. And I understand that the power and potency of the word of Christ, and also the ways in which deliverance are referenced from the Old Testament to the New Testament, being there with Ed Johnson while they themselves experience what it means to live in society where they're in a state of being accused of just being lesser than, and imagine the moral and psychological toll that would take, but being galvanized and buoyed by the church, by the gospel, by the Spirit, standing with Ed Johnson and testifying to the fact that while Ed Johnson is in this case specifically accused of being of a certain criminal status, that they themselves collectively were accused of being another kind of vile status and even condemned through the scriptures. But they knew better. They knew the text. They knew the word. And they knew that perhaps if there was one truer Christian faith in the country, that it was the one preached from their churches on Sundays versus somehow across town, when you would have pastors preaching from white communities at a lynching on a Saturday night, and then on Sunday morning preaching about the grace, mercy, and forgiveness through the blood of Jesus. So the ecosystem and the infrastructure of testifying, Ed Johnson and the church. And also, Ray, your questions are, man, I appreciate what you bring to your questions, both the insight and warmth that you put even into how you frame the questions. I'm testifying now to your questions. Yeah, so these are great.
I want to note that the sheriff invited the pastor. He didn't necessarily invite the congregation, but the pastor reached out, not only invited the congregation, but the choir. And I picture the choir in their robes, I don't know, but I picture them wearing their robes and being there present. And as you know, the congregation was so large, they didn't fit in the jail. They overflowed into the courtyard. But they sang when he was baptized, they sang hymns, and they said those hymns were heard for blocks around. And they sang hymns that we know and we still sing today. And I was struck by that. Let's see, when the roll is called up yonder, Amazing Grace, and then the Sweet By and By, these are good old hymns, but I can hear them. I can hear them singing.
And such a contrast between this gathering in and around the jail compared to the one when Ed Johnson was first brought into custody, or the crowd that would gather soon after this particular crowd came to the jail and brought church to Ed Johnson.
I think, though, that we should also remember that there was some activity in the white church, that there were some ministers who sought to give leadership and calmness to this situation. I think the name really, one was named McCauley. Yeah.
That's right.
Yes, he was
there. Thank you, Reverend, for bringing that up, because that is true. My great-grandfather was a pastor at this time, although he had retired, but he was still associated with the Pastors Association, the White Pastors Association. And according to Contempt of Court, the book, he went to the Pastors Association and asked them to all preach that Sunday. Now, this is a Sunday before, or an earlier one, when they had an attempted lynching, not only to stop the lynching, but to advocate a resolution of 10 different points, admonishing this behavior, saying that lynching was wrong, it was a sin, that had to be confessed, and trying to stop from the white pulpit these kinds of behaviors. So there was some effort in the white community as well.
Yes, and even those efforts were at a greater risk than those of the Black community. I've always felt that it was the almost expected of the Black pastor, the Black church, to take the leadership here of support. But the white pastor runs a greater chance of being very negative. And if I'm not mistaken, the pastor of the First Baptist Church spoke out, preached on the same lawlessness and the sin of what they were seeking to do. And I think his house was burned or something like that. He experienced violent reactions. So even though I feel that's the call of all Black and white to proclaim justice and mercy and love for one another, even at a risk, but I feel that there are some who have greater risk than others. And we ought to at least respect that, and yet we condemn those who remain silent in the midst of such lawlessness and not speak of the Christ whom they profess.
And one could say that Reverend McCauley was moving out of the prophetic tradition And we know that no one really likes the prophets, at least at that time. So in real time, he was speaking to them, asking them to speak from their pulpits about the sin which was to come forth, that communal national sin of lynching, that it was indeed ungodly. It was a sin. And one of the things that we Americans like, we like to believe that we are the most just nation, perhaps the greatest, the most moral nation of all time. And so to have a pastor from their own community speaking about their own sin, which of course they didn't see as such, I could imagine could strike a moral chord, or as pastors noted, that people can respond with the spirit of retaliation when they believe that they've been called forth in an unjust fashion. Or maybe they know in their heart of hearts that even though this is culturally normative, that it's still morally decayed and morally wrong.
We should also reflect on when this took place, 1906, slightly more than 40 years after the end of the Civil War. Reconstruction, the end of Reconstruction, the rise of Jim Crow segregation. We're only 10 years after the U.S. Supreme Court ruling Plessy versus Ferguson. For so many of these people, all of these things, they either lived through them themselves or they were the sons and daughters of those who did.
Yes, I want to note that Noah Pardon and Stiles Hutchins were products of Reconstruction.
In our last conversation, we told you about Pardon and Hutchins, the two African-American lawyers in Chattanooga who appealed Ed Johnson's case all the way to the United States Supreme Court.
Because of Reconstruction, they were able to get the education to go to law school and to start a legal practice, to be already established in a legal practice in 1906. Also, some of the other characters that are part of the story, Judge Marshall Harlan.
Justice John Marshall Harlan was the son of a Kentucky slave owner who authored the sole dissenting opinion in Plessy versus Ferguson, the Supreme Court decision in 1896, which upheld the racial segregation of public facilities as constitutional, provided they were, quote, separate but equal.
And he said at that time that our Constitution is colorblind. It protects everyone. So he was the one who was in position when Noah Pardon went to Washington. We know that when he went, he was hoping to talk to Judge Marshall Harlan, but he didn't know for sure who would address him. Any judge could have been the one on duty that day, but Judge Marshall Harlan, John Marshall Harlan, was the one who was supposed to hear cases from the 6th District, which Tennessee is a part. So Noah Pardon was very lucky when he went that he got to address this case of Ed Johnson to the one member of the Supreme Court who was waiting, who had been waiting. And he said he had been waiting 30 years for this case. And why? Because this was an opportunity for the federal judgeship to intervene into a state's rights court. And he called it state's wrongs. These were things the states were doing that they had no right to do. And this was an opportunity for him to intervene.
The Civil War was supposed to have already settled that argument. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments to the United States Constitution were already supposed to have settled that argument.
But it did not, and Reconstruction was necessary. And I, as a Southerner, as a white Southerner, I wish Reconstruction had lasted longer and been more severe, but it wasn't. Even so, I want us to note that even those 12 years that it existed, it allowed opportunities for Black men, particularly who were of the right age, to take advantage of the opportunities for education and even for election. Many of them were elected to positions. In fact, Stiles Hutchins himself was elected to the Tennessee legislature, beating a white man by just a few votes for at least one term. But both of them, Stiles Hutchins and Noah Pardon, had law degrees and were in practice by 1906 so that they could address a case like this. And then when Jim Crow set in and Reconstruction ended, Blacks did not have that opportunity for another 50 years.
Eleanor is referring to Brown versus Board of Education, the Supreme Court decision in 1954, which overturned Plessy versus Ferguson. Reverend McDaniel is familiar with the Supreme Court. In the 1970s, the court sided with him and overturned a state of Tennessee law that barred ministers from serving on county governing bodies. And speaking of the United States Supreme Court, Reverend McDaniel, you have a story to share with us about appearing before the court when Thurgood Marshall was a justice, the first African-American justice on that court.
Yes, I had that privilege after I had sought to run for a seat in the 1976, I think, Constitutional Convention, Tennessee. And I was challenged because there is a article, I think Article 9 of the Tennessee Constitution, that prohibits ministers and clergy of all faith from serving in the assembly. And one of my opponents knew that. And so once I was given a go from the registration election commission that this lady called and told me about it and said she was going to challenge me if I didn't drop out. So I told her to do what she had to do, and I'll do what I had to do. And she took me to court, and on the state court here in Chattanooga, that the judge reversed and declared that article unconstitutional. We went on and had the election. I won, and the state Supreme Court heard it on appeal and reversed the decision of the lower court, declared my seat vacant. And for some reason, this little small town preacher said to the news folks, "We're going to the U.S. Supreme Court." But I was blessed with two lawyers, didn't pay them a penny. But we did have expenses that the community responded. And we went to the U.S. Supreme Court and got a decision of 8-0 that reaffirmed the position of the first judge. It was interesting that two of the state Supreme Court judges were from Chattanooga. And I only see one vote against, and the one vote, then four votes against me, one vote for me. But we made it, and it was quite a jump to move to that point. And I thought about Ed Johnson. Ed Johnson, a uneducated black man, young man with no regular employment, no permanent home, no wife, no kids. He had a father, we know that. So the father came to Noah to move for the appeal. And I was told that he had a mother who was in Atlanta at the bus station once, and a person from Chattanooga. So I talked with her and said, "He's from Chattanooga." And she said, "That Chattanooga's a bad place, for they killed my son." So he did have a mother. But think of it, here's such a man. His name rang forth in the U.S. Supreme Court, and God had to be in it to use lawyers and people of goodwill, both black and white, to make a very historic legal case of the Supreme Court dealing with a state and local court and the institution of racism. So it was a man like Ed Johnson who died that God worked through that case. And I still believe he's still working.
I'd like to think that he's working right here, right now, along with us in this conversation.
Yes, I think so.
More than 60 years after he was lynched, Thurgood Marshall was nominated and confirmed to be the first African-American justice on the United States Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. This is the same Thurgood Marshall who argued in front of that court in Brown versus Board of Education, the decision that struck down Plessy versus Ferguson in 1896.
But it was interesting. It was the same Marshall that during my trial, my attorney was arguing about racism, and he turned around in his chair and said, "This is no civil rights case." Yes, that it was it had nothing to do with race. It dealt with the clergy, yeah, religion, separation of church and state. So it was a significant and a historic move to clear the record that there was no limitation for a person because of his profession to serve and to run for election and to serve after being elected.
It's another example, I think, of how a court decision in one moment applied to a specific set of circumstances can have a ripple effect years or even decades later. And that also applies to the stay that was issued by Justice John Marshall Harlan in 1906.
And we're dealing with the idea of really states' rights. And that was basic in that area where the states felt that the feds had no right to interfere. And this was a historic movement by our Supreme Court to deal with racism that was found in our state courts. So it was a significant decision that was used and started because of Ed Johnson's situation, but because of two strong Black lawyers who were not like some of our Black professionals, turn their backs on others and do not want to risk their position or the pressure from their peers. But these two did. And even though later on they had a negative attitude toward Chattanooga, because when the case came back to be tried in Chattanooga by the sheriff and others, that they did not participate. Yeah.
When Noah Pardon and Stiles Hutchins decided to take this case, even they knew it would end their careers in Chattanooga. Let me take us back to that Sunday. Noah Pardon was on the train coming back from Washington. He left on Saturday. It was an overnight train. He did not know what the conclusion was. His presentation before Judge John Marshall Harlan was about 10 minutes long. He left the documents. He didn't know while he was traveling overnight. Harlan had read the documents. He called the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. They met that Sunday morning, the whole Supreme Court, in the home of the Chief Justice, and they made a decision based on the documents and the testimony that Noah Pardon had made to issue a stay of execution for enough time to hear the case. They sent notice of this stay by telegram. The justice sent a telegram to the sheriff, to the acting attorney general in Chattanooga, and to other officials that needed to know. And one of them was to the office of Noah Pardon and Stiles Hutchins. So when Noah Pardon arrived on the train in Chattanooga, he was met by Stiles Hutchins waving a piece of paper. And Stiles Hutchins gave him that piece of paper, and he looked at it and saw that he had been successful. His attempt to present Ed Johnson's case had created a stay of execution. And I'm sure there was great joy in those two men.
And it was a telegram because that was the communication medium of the time. The telephone was still in its infancy, and we had not, as a population, heard of radio or television. They were still way into the future. They received the word about that stay. Then the mob came along and decided what they were going to do and what they had to say about that stay.
When Sheriff Shipp received the telegram notifying him that his prisoner was now under federal control, in other words, he was no longer Sheriff Shipp's prisoner. He was the prisoner of the federal government. Sheriff Shipp relented, gave up. He just gave up protection. Instead of protecting his prisoner as he should have, he gave up. He told his deputies to leave, and he left the jail virtually unguarded. Just one jailer was there that night. Now, somebody else will tell that story, but that's the setup, is the telegram came and the sheriff was angry that his efforts were null and void, and he no longer wanted to protect this prisoner.
This is another illustration of the deep feelings that many Southerners and Southern states have against the feds, federal government. They don't want to have any interference. But I feel like the black population especially should never share those feelings, because much of our freedom has come through the Supreme Court, through the federal government, and not from our own states. Yeah,
I'm not trying to be funny, but one could say that it wasn't the posturing or the act of small government that co-labored with African-American interests and African-American labor and African-American intelligence and the prophetic unction and organizing that had been going on for centuries, but it was the act of big government overreach, one could have said at that time. So not that big government overreach is in and of itself a good thing, but in our case, it has been to the benefit of the African-American community. But also, it turned out to kind of affirm some of the ideals expressed in the Constitution. And I understand that the Justice Harlan believed that the Constitution was colorblind, but it was implicitly, structurally written by people who were of a narrow portion of the population. They were white landowning men, and they wrote it to protect their interests. So I don't want us to get it twisted. And so I understand I want to affirm the ideals of the Constitution, but I think that it was actually neutral, because if it was neutral, there never would have been a need for a 13th, 14th, or 15th Amendment to the Constitution. And I want to take a moment just to imagine that long train ride back, because I've never had the privilege and the honor of being within the Supreme Court, and certainly, like Pastor, did not have a case of my own being argued at the Supreme Court. So that to me is utterly remarkable that he's had that experience and wasn't just there, wasn't having a case argued, but actually was victorious. And at that time in the early part of the 20th century, in the midst of all what racism was at the time, to have an African-American lawyer arguing in front of a Supreme Court justice. And, you know, I have done some public speaking from time to time, but also played sports in the past. And, you know, that moment, but right before you have to perform, sometimes there's that mixture of fear, that mixture of excitement. So I was this weekend when talking to Eleanor, I was just imagining what it felt like for the lawyer to utter his first words before the Supreme Court. And I imagine perhaps that he knew all along that he had the capacity to be sharp, shrewd, and eloquent enough to make a viable case to be received by the person in Judge Harlan who was waiting to hear this kind of case, who was waiting to step in to enact justice for the Negro community, as we were called at the time. And so on that ride back, maybe he sensed that he was victorious, or maybe he thought his stomach was turning that entire time home, not knowing what was to happen. So I can imagine the delight and sheer joy he felt once he received the notice that indeed Ed Johnson was not to be executed, that he was not to be touched, and that the Supreme Court stood in to protect someone who was innocent. And so that's something I think is worth noting as well, just the process that the lawyer had experienced in arguing the Supreme Court case, waiting for it, and then getting that news on his return to Chattanooga.
Reverend McDaniel, Eleanor Donovan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ray.
In our next conversation, a violent mob takes the law into its own hands and takes the life of Ed Johnson on the Walnut Street Bridge. Joining us for that conversation, Kevin Bate. And here in this excerpt, LaFrederick Thurkill.
Here we are still talking about Ed Johnson's name, but he has never been exonerated. His name was cleared in the Hamilton County court records, but he has not been exonerated.
And there is a difference in legal terms.
Almost definitely. But after all these years, this man has still not yet been exonerated. His name was cleared in 2000 when Reverend McDaniel and some other clergy members went before the Hamilton County courts to have his name cleared in Hamilton County, but at the federal level, he has never been exonerated. You know, I even reached out and wrote President Obama a letter on behalf of Ed Johnson to try to make that happen, but I'm sure my little letter probably got lost in the hundreds of thousands of ones that were there, but to this day. And so that's a fight that I want to continue to encourage people to look into. He should be exonerated. So we can build these memorials to him and we can write plays and write books and all of this stuff. But the systemic racism is still in place, knowing that with all the evidence that's available, somebody should have said, hey, let's exonerate this man. And it should have happened way before 2021.
Yeah.
But it's still sad to know that this man's name has yet not been fully cleared.
And would that be up to the federal courts, state courts, a combination?
I think it'd be a combination of the state and federal courts, because although the Supreme Court ordered a stay of execution, he wasn't exonerated at that level, and he wasn't exonerated at the state court level. And so I think it comes from the federal level, but at any level, he's not been exonerated. And I'd encourage anybody that's listening to this to do the same. Let's do that. Let's make that happen. If we can get one name cleared in 2021, it should be the name of Ed Johnson.
Our thanks to the Reverend Paul A. McDaniel, Eleanor McCauley Cooper, Donovan Brown, the members of the Ed Johnson Project, and to Tony R. Smith Sr., Willie Kitchens, and their fellow musicians for I Am an Innocent Man, the Ed Johnson song. Visit the Ed Johnson Project at its website, edjohnsonproject.com, and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC.